This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have in the studio Wendell Potter, the whistleblower for the health insurance industry, who did so much to expose their outrageous practices. Wendell Potter is the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He's now written a great book about his experience, about the history of health insurance battles in America, the history of PR in America, and what we can do about it. The book is called Deadly Spin. Wendell Potter, thanks for joining me again on
Thank you,
Progressive
Matt.
Radio. It's great to have you back.
Thank you.
Your book's gotten some attention. I saw on Democracy Now! and saw you on MSNBC, especially talking about Michael Moore
and
Sicko. You were the chief flack for Cigna at the time, and you went to one of the early screenings, and you write about that in this book. What was your instant reaction when you saw that early screening?
Well, two reactions. One is, oh, boy, I can't believe I'm going to have to defend Cigna after this movie and how Cigna's portrayed in the movie. And the other was my heart wasn't in it because I knew that he was very careful in the way he did that to make sure it was factual. Of course, it had a point of view, but he got it right. He portrayed our healthcare system very accurately, and as well the healthcare systems abroad too.
Wendell Potter, you claim that the health insurance industry was prepared for Sicko, that people in the industry, or at least in your company, didn't refer to Michael Moore as Michael Moore, but as Hollywood, and didn't want his name to appear so that an email would leak out and embarrass the industry. And also that actually your work and the industry's work succeeded in marginalizing Sicko in some way. How did you do that?
We mounted a very, very successful campaign that was conducted behind the scenes. And by that I mean there's no evidence that the health insurance industry was behind it. But the health insurance industry financed it and planned it and carried it out by getting others to be their spokespeople and to use their talking points. And it's very much of a classic kind of PR campaign that big corporations conduct these days based on the campaigns that were really developed for the tobacco industry many years ago. You use stealth campaigns. It's a stealth campaign, and you use front groups, you use third parties, you get your talking points in the hands of friendly politicians and friendly people in the media and your business and business allies.
And one of those front groups was called Healthcare America.
Right.
I mean, almost all these front groups have the most antiseptic names possible.
By design. A lot of time and money goes into research and to use the use of linguistics to develop the right to pick the right combination of words to make people think that this is an American organization and that it's really a true grassroots organization.
And how, by the name of it, how could you oppose it? That's the implication.
Well, that's it. And, of course, it's anything but an American type of an organization, certainly anything but a grassroots. They're also known as AstroTurf groups. There really were no citizens involved in this. The funding came exclusively from big pharma and big insurance to set this up. And and it was nothing more than a vehicle to spread misinformation.
And to smear Michael Moore in a way, you say there was a plan there to describe him as nuts and as radioactive, or at least radioactive for centrist Democrats who would be swing voters on this. You added something else in here, that there was a secret plan to, quote-unquote, push Moore off the cliff. What did you mean by that?
It wasn't literal, I don't think. The reference was made to the stages of the campaign. If the preliminary efforts, the preliminary tactics weren't succeeding, and if Sicko was doing exceedingly well at the box office and centrist Democrats and others were talking about it and embracing it and saying this is something people should see, then they would have to push Michael Moore off the cliff, and they would redouble efforts to discredit him, to attack him as his character, his patriotism, his ideas about our country. So the idea would have been to make him be perceived as so much out of the mainstream of American thought and belief that no one would take him seriously.
But you didn't need to do that, even though the industry didn't haul out, at least according to your account, this second tier heavy gun.
Right. This was part of a worst-case scenario planning, and it wasn't perceived necessary because the movie, while it did fairly, you know, modestly well, in fact, in terms of documentaries, it did pretty well, but nothing close to what Fahrenheit 9/11 did. And it didn't, as the industry thought, move the collective conscience of the country.
It was a great movie, though. I thought it was his best movie, but maybe it just ran into those headwinds that you were helping to whip up and the industry was helping to whip up. Yeah. One last question on Michael Moore, because I heard him on Democracy Now! Suggesting that he'd actually been receiving some very scary threats that he didn't enumerate, and she asked him about the unsettling suggestion he was making. Do you know anything about that?
I still don't. I'm not sure exactly what was going on, although I'm not surprised. Industry and government are very much involved, often working together, and politicians. I don't know what he was referring to, but these entities, these special interests, play to keep, and they play to win, and they will often stop at nothing to get what they
yeah.
want.
And they play hardball. I want to. Your story itself interests me, and the whole question of how people work. For say the tobacco companies, that's the most obvious case. How can you be a PR flack for the tobacco company or an attorney for the tobacco companies? And you said you engaged in self talk to get through the day, and that other people were doing that. Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, I started my job in the industry as a real believer in managed care, and I thought that it was an appropriate means of providing quality health care to larger and larger numbers of people, that it could maybe play a very significant role, if not the lead role, in broadening access. So I came into this from nonprofit health care, thinking that if I were to be involved with a much larger organization, the status didn't make all that much difference. But I found out otherwise pretty quickly, and certainly toward the end of my career. But I for a long time, I kept clinging to the notion that for-profit companies could help be a solution, that they were genuinely interested in solving some of our problems. That was one thing. And in fact, most of the people who work in these companies are pretty much like I was for most of my career. They just are not able to see what really goes on in the executive suites until you get, I guess you would say, the privilege of being able to work in the executive suite. And they also didn't see what I saw, because one of the things that I was doing that was unique to my position was being able to not only work within the company, but also within the industry with my peers to help plan strategy, to help plan things like the attack on SICKO, and to plan the strategy to influence healthcare reform. It was only toward the end of my career that I was able to do this, and also toward the end of my career that I was able to see exactly what these companies do to make sure they're meeting Wall Street's expectations. That's the chief objective, I found out later on.
And you said to meet Wall Street's objectives, they had to not shell out money to patients who need the coverage, and that there's a
right.
ratio there that if it gets over a certain point, which means, you know, you're paying claims that people have gotten insured so that you could pay claims to them and they could get their insurance, that if you're paying too much, Wall Street punishes you.
Oh, it does. And that was one of the main things I wanted to convey to Congress when I testified before Congress the first time, was to make sure that members of Congress knew that this goes on. I learned that members of Congress and their staff know not very much at all about the private health insurance industry. They know Medicare and Medicaid and the public programs fairly well, but not so much how private companies operate and their allegiance to Wall Street. But what you're talking about is very key to how they make money. They are able to siphon off a lot of what we send them in premiums to reward shareholders and to reward the executives and avoid paying claims. And there is relentless pressure from Wall Street, from the shareholders, to make sure that they pay less and less and less on claims and medical care all the time.
And is that pressure going to persist after the Obama law got passed, or are they going to have to play a few different games?
They'll have to play some different games, and of course they will, because they have to figure out ways to keep Wall Street happy. Otherwise, the stock price will go down. I saw one company, Aetna's stock price, go down 20% in one day when it disappointed Wall Street with this medical loss ratio, which, by the way, is a measure of how much they spend of a premium dollar on medical care compared to the total amount of premium dollar they get. And that's the most important measure for Wall Street. So they will be looking for ways to game the system. The new law requires them to spend at least 80% of what we send them in premiums on medical care. They don't like that. They'll want to try to get this new Congress to change that if they can, or to get the regulators to be lenient with them.
There's no chance of that happening, though, maybe with the regulators, but not. I don't think Congress is going to, not with Obama as president, succeed in repealing or severely retracting health care reform, is there?
I don't think so. Now, what they will do, they will mount a big campaign, just like they have done in the past, to make us think that some of the things that really are in our best interest are not. One example is during the 90s and early part of the 2000s, the industry mounted a huge campaign that was successful in persuading lawmakers and the public into thinking that the patient's Bill of Rights that had bipartisan support in Congress was not in their best interest. They developed a very effective fear-mongering campaign, and the legislation was never enacted. They'll be using the same tactics to make us think that the consumer protections and these new regulations are going to be harmful to us, and they will say that it will be causing us to have higher premium costs going forward.
You saw the weaknesses in the health care reform bill that passed, and you finally decided to support it. What are some of the pluses that some people on the progressive side may not have noticed that you thought were important to get passed, even though it wasn't the best bill as far as public option goes and other things?
Well, I don't like the way that it actually requires all of us to get coverage and buy coverage from the private insurance companies, but we do need to get everybody in coverage. This will at least bring more people into coverage, and that will save lives, quite frankly. I think ultimately we can figure out better ways to bring people into coverage, but this, in my view, is just kind of a stopgap. It'll save some lives in the near term, but it will do that in other ways too. It will close the donut hole eventually that senior citizens face in the drug benefit. Right now, senior citizens have to pay a big percentage of their medications after the government has paid a certain amount. This will begin to close that. A lot of senior citizens just stop taking their medications when their benefit runs out, and that's a very dangerous thing. And people are dying as a result of that. It will enable people to families to keep their children on the policies until at least age 26 if those adult children have not been able to get jobs that offer benefits. It will also make illegal some of the most egregious practices of the industry. It will prohibit them from refusing to sell us insurance if we've been sick in the past, if we have had a pre-existing condition, and it will prohibit them from canceling our insurance when we get sick, which has also been another prevalent practice of the insurance industry.
It must have been a great moment for you when you not only testified before Congress, but you were there in Congress when the president gave a speech about health care and mentioned your name. Did you know that was coming? And just tell me how that felt.
I did not know. A congressman had invited me to attend the speech. I had agreed to speak at his town hall, which was one of those very disrupted town hall meetings that was very raucous. And I think as a favor, he gave, managed to get me into the House gallery. I did not know it was coming. It was just going along. I was following his speech, and then he quotes this former health insurance executive, and for my Senate testimony, I almost fell out of the gallery.
So this former health insurance executive is named Wendell Potter. He's my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. And it's been quite a journey for you. You talk about a couple epiphanies you had, turning points here, and I just wanted you to discuss two of them that you mentioned. One was this almost MASH unit in Virginia, in rural Virginia, where there was, you described the scene.
Yeah, I had just out of a, it was just very coincidental. I picked up my hometown newspaper when I was visiting my folks and read about this expedition at the Wise County Fairgrounds in Southwest Virginia, just a few miles from where I grew up in northeastern Tennessee. When I walked through the fairground gates, I saw something I would never have thought I would have seen in this country. Undoubtedly people I could have grown up with and probably did grow up with were standing in these lines that stretched out of view. And these folks were soaking wet. It was raining. And I noticed pretty quickly that these lines led in many cases to animal stalls and to barns. And what made it look like a MASH unit was there were tents all over the fairgrounds as well. that there weren't enough barns and animal stalls to care for all
people
these
in
folks.
Animal stalls. And it was raining out, and people were on gurneys in the rain.
People, yes, exactly. And they were being treated, and it was just on rain-soaked pavement. There was no dignity and no privacy, because I was wandering around looking at seeing people being cared for. And I had my camera. I recorded this partly for myself, just to make sure that what I was saying wasn't a dream, because it was dreamlike. It was surreal that I was actually still in the United States to see something like this.
And you had been tasked to write a in-house document saying the problem of the uninsured wasn't so great in America. So you must have been bombarded with cognitive dissonance at this stage.
It was because one of the things that begins to happen to people is once you start telling something, even if you initially know that it's not necessarily true, you begin to believe it. And that was what was going on with me. Although I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable working on things that clearly was intended to mislead people. When I saw what I saw in Wise County, I knew that what I was doing was wrong. I was trying to mislead people into thinking that things like this would not possibly happen in the U.S., that people who were uninsured were people who did that by choice. Well, I knew without a doubt that those people who were there did not want to be standing in long lines getting soaking wet to get care in animal stalls.
Hmm. Speaking with Wendell Potter, he is the author of Deadly Spin. He also works at the Center for Media and Democracy. The other event that had a huge influence on you was a story of a young woman named Nadeline, I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Nadeline Sarkeesian.
Nadeline, and she was 17, and she had leukemia, and she needed a liver transplant. And what happened?
She was enrolled in a Cigna plan, and she was enrolled in a plan that had benefits that covered transplants. Her parents knew this. She was scheduled for a transplant. A perfect match had been found, and she was scheduled to have this procedure done early in the morning, and her parents arrived to be there with her. The doctors took them aside, though, and said, "I'm sorry that we have to tell you that we can't go forward because Cigna hasn't given us clearance." And the family didn't know what to think about that. Why would an insurance company have anything to say about whether this procedure could go forward? And they said that a medical director at Cigna had refused to authorize payment for it, coverage for it, because he felt it was experimental. And the family was obviously just devastated. They were just baffled. They couldn't figure this out. They knew they were covered. In fact, now the family is very much involved in trying to make people aware of the fact that just because you think your policy will cover something doesn't necessarily mean it will. The family, though, was very resourceful, and they were able to get a lot of public attention brought to this case, to the point that over several days, Cigna realized it was getting a very big PR black eye. And I was a guy who was on the hot seat handling calls from reporters who were calling about this, and from outraged members of the public who just couldn't believe that it was going on either. So Cigna decided to eventually reverse that denial.
And that was your advice, too.
It was. I told my boss and the CEO and others that you've got to understand the PR consequences of what's going on here and know that we're talking about a 17-year-old girl. Keep that in mind. And the company did agree to cover it. And the family was overjoyed when they got the news. They were staging a protest in front of Cigna's offices, regional offices in Glendale, California. And I was watching. It was covered by live TV. CNN was covering it. And I was able to see when someone whispered in her mother's ear that Cigna was going to cover it, and they were just overjoyed. The sad thing, I wish it had a happy ending, but it came too late. By the time that decision was made to cover it, days had passed, and her other organs were beginning to shut down, and she was no longer eligible for the transplant, and she died just hours later.
Oh, that is a tragic story. So hard to read in your book, Deadly Spin. I'm speaking with the author, Wendell Potter, a whistleblower, has done tremendous work over the last 3 years in exposing the practices of the health insurance companies and the strategies of PR people in that industry and other industries. He's done as much as anyone probably to get the kind of health care reform that we got. To the extent that we got it, you can thank Wendell Potter. I just want to continue with your personal story just for a little bit, because personal stories interest me so much. What was the reaction when you went in and told your boss you didn't want to do this anymore?
Well, they were surprised to a certain extent, but they were beginning to tell that I didn't have my heart in what I was doing anymore. And I had, as I told my boss, I'd had a good long ride of 15 years almost with Cigna, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I was burned out. I was just not the person that I felt they needed to have in that job to do what they felt they needed to do. And earlier, I knew that my boss was realizing how I was feeling. She said, "Wendell, you don't seem to be engaged." And I knew then that it was showing. That not only that, I had some conversations with folks I told many people what I had seen in Wise County, Virginia, that health fair we talked about. And I had stayed long enough that I thought maybe I could make some difference from the inside to try to change perspectives on healthcare reform. But I realized that was futile because, again, you have to meet Wall Street's expectations. And that is number one. That's the thing that has to be done every 3 months. And they asked me to stay on, and I agreed to do it for a while. They didn't have anyone. They didn't think I would ever leave, I guess. So there was no real good succession planning. So I stayed on for a little while longer before I walked out the door for the last time.
Now, you said there was a price. Were there any repercussions after you started to open your mouth?
No, not significant. Now, I've had my hits on the internet from folks who are not giving me any slack and who are accusing me of this or that. But it's been more of a rewarding experience than anything I ever could have imagined. Before I gave my testimony, I was thinking of the worst case scenario of my own, and I figured that I would be attacked, that they would go after me personally, they would attack my character, that I would probably have no chance of working again. I had to come to terms with that, and I felt so compelled to do this that I was willing to take that risk. But knock on wood, it has been just the opposite. I've had opportunities I never would have imagined, and I'm still going.
And you look like a happy man. Besides,
I'm a happy man. I was visiting on my book tour. I went back to Hartford, Connecticut, where Cigna's healthcare operations are based, and where I used to work. And I spent the night with former next door neighbors, and they said the next day that I look like an entirely different person. Mm. I'm older than I was, but they said, "You're smiling all the time." And they said, "I don't remember you smiling much at all back then." And it's true. I smile a lot. I laugh a lot. I have a good time. I feel like I'm doing the right thing. And that's that when I say I'm having a good time. It doesn't feel like work. It feels like I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, there's a lesson there. I mean, you really took the moral path because you write in the book that you were wondering where your morality had went, and then you found it. And it's an incredible story, Deadly Spin. Wendell Potter's the author. I want to talk in the last 5 minutes we have about a couple things, and that is about the media and about how to break through PR spin wherever it's coming from. You write, while you were doing PR for Cigna, that you were astonished that the reporters didn't provide much scrutiny to the industry at that time, and it must have gotten worse by now because the media newspapers are laying people off right and left and folding. What hope do we have of getting scrutiny of industry practices, not just in the healthcare industry, with the decline of the corporate media?
Well, we've got to figure out what to do about this decline of the mainstream media. I think that will continue. So we will have some other model of what media looks like. I think it's still evolving. I'm hopeful, and I know that there are some who share this, that we will have more. Nonprofit journalism and journalistic organizations that are funded by people who provide grant money to do that. I hope that's the case because I think journalism can operate best if there is no one making a profit off of. One of the things that has happened, and one of the reasons why we have fewer journalists and less investigative reporting, is because most of our mainstream media is now owned by big corporations, mm-hmm. and they're interest is just like the insurance companies. is making a buck rather than serving the public. So I'm hopeful. And also with the rise of the internet and web-based communications, it's a double-edged sword because those who advocate for the status quo also know how to use it. But it is also a vehicle that enables people in large numbers to get involved in a conversation and to a certain extent be citizen journalists. There's the opportunity for that. But I'm hopeful that people will realize that we need to contribute to organizations that are truly interested in keeping investigative journalism alive.
And by the same token, you note, as does John Nichols and Robert McChesney, that the percentage of PR people to journalists has gone way up as there are fewer and fewer journalists out there. And at least paid journalists and more or professional journalists and more PR people.
Yeah, and that's and I was a journalist, and I did what a lot of former journalists are doing, leaving the profession, many involuntarily, and are winding up in PR jobs. I left voluntarily, but many people in journalism don't have the option of working in journalism anymore and get paid for it. So they're taking PR jobs, and there is a huge imbalance now. When I first was reporting, that wasn't detectable. I mean, I wasn't aware of that. But now the balance continues to get out of kilter.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do we, as a consumer, not really as a journalist for me, but as a consumer, the person who's listening to the show in her car or in his kitchen or at the office, how do we penetrate the spin? How do we lift the veil? How do we figure out when we're being hornswoggled?
Well, first, there are two words that I offer as advice in the book. Be skeptical. That's the first step. Don't be as gullible. And I'm sorry to have to say this, but don't trust people as much as you have trusted them in the past. And that's because that's one of the reasons we've gotten this predicament is that we are so trusting that the people who are giving us information in the media and in politics are leveling with us, but it's not the truth in many cases. They're shills for big corporate interest or other special interest, and we need to be wise to that, that it's going on all the time, that we are constantly the victims of invisible persuasion, as I put it in the book. So awareness is one thing. And as you become aware, notice the organizations that are behind some of this spin. Usually, when you're seeing commercials or advertisements, there's at least some sponsor, and it could be an organization like Healthcare America that was ginned up to attack Sitco. Go to sourcewatch.org, and I'm plugging that in particular because it is something that the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin created to try to inform people of who is behind some of these front groups. You could go to sourcewatch.org and type in Healthcare America, and you would pull up a lot of information about how that organization came to be and who provided the funding and who were the principals involved in it. So those organizations, by the way, deserve a lot of funding. Center for Media and Democracy does a lot of work in this area. And another plug, they're a nonprofit. They rely on donations, and they do incredibly valuable work to make sure that we are alert to spin and know what to do about it.
And they did a great job grabbing you. That was something that was from heaven for that organization, it seems to me, because you've done, Wendell Potter, so much great work on this issue and to draw attention to the PR tactics and also to what's wrong with our healthcare industry. So I want to thank you again for being my guest on Progressive Radio, and I want to urge the listener to not only go to sourcewatch.org or prwatch.org, but read Deadly Spin, Wendell Potter's book.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.